I'm Heather Vogel with ProPublica, and I'm talking today with three reporters from the Indy Star newspaper, Marissa Kwiatkowski, Mark Alicia, and Tim Evans, about their incredible report on sexual misconduct by gymnastics coaches affiliated with USA Gymnastics, the nonprofit responsible for developing the United States gymnastics team for the Olympics. The reporters discovered that the organization had a policy related to reporting such abuse that was almost sure, experts say, to discourage people from speaking up about it. These are stunning revelations on a subject that's very hard to report, and I imagine the gymnastics world is pretty insular. So, first of all, just kudos to all of you for your hard work bringing this to light. And I know that work isn't done yet. Thanks, Marissa, Mark, and Tim, for being here. I'm hoping y'all can just tell me a little bit about how you first got onto this story.
Sure. So we initially received a tip about this story out of other reporting that we'd been doing about failures to report child sexual abuse in local school districts and daycares. And as we were doing sort of a broader story about why is this so common, why does this keep happening in all of these different locations, we received a tip about USA Gymnastics having a policy of not reporting all allegations of sexual abuse involving its coaches.
Now, tell me a little bit, first of all, what USA Gymnastics is, just for listeners who may not be completely aware of the organization. Why is it important, and why are you all interested in Indiana in it?
Yeah, USA Gymnastics is the legally designated national governing body for the sport in the United States. It is responsible for not only developing and producing Olympic teams and teams for international competition, but also sanctioning competition at the local level. Its members include 3,000 gyms nationwide. I think it's about 121,000 athletes and coaches. The members range all the way from the people you'll see at the Olympics to kids just getting started in the sport, not even at a competitive level.
It's a nonprofit, right?
It is.
And do they hire the coaches, or is it the gyms that hire the coaches? Is there sort of a step between them? But they do certify them? Is that how it works? Or what is the process? What is their relationship with the coaches?
They don't hire the coaches. The coaches are members, and they must adhere to standards set by USA Gymnastics. And USA Gymnastics is headquartered in Indianapolis, so that's another reason that, you know, we were keenly interested in this. But they don't hire or directly supervise the coaches.
Tell me some more about that policy that you got the tip about. You didn't actually get a tip about a case in that instance. You actually started with a policy. Is that right?
We had received a tip about sort of a broader policy of handling, but the revelations of that policy, the officials talking about that policy, did come out of a court case in Georgia. And basically what we found through, you know, depositions and other records in the case is that two former USA Gymnastics executives said that they had a policy of dismissing allegations of sexual abuse as hearsay unless they came directly from a victim or a victim's parent, which is something that legal and child welfare advocates told us is not a good policy to have.
How is this similar, and how is it different from what the newspaper had found in schools and daycares, for instance? Was this a gray area, or was this clearly a problem? I mean, how did you draw this particular organization sort of into your view of looking at how this mandatory reporter laws work?
I think what makes this different from the writing that we had done and the investigations that we've done relating to public and private schools and daycares failing to report is that those were really individual official decision-making. The assistant principal who was talking to HR, or it was the head of school who didn't make the report or something like that. What made USA Gymnastics different through our investigation is that they actually had a policy, an executive policy, of how they handle all of these allegations. So it wasn't just a case-by-case basis. It was more of a broad policy for handling these situations.
And that policy was, on its face, problematic. Tell me some more about that and why it was problematic.
Well, what legal and child welfare experts told us is that this policy sort of flies in the face of best practice because, you know, often the victim doesn't want to put that in writing or go straight to authorities. They may tell a friend or a trusted adult or someone like that, but they're actually putting it in writing and sending it to the organization. You know, in some ways, experts told us, is a deterrent to reporting.
Because it creates a hurdle?
Partly because of what Marissa said, and then also partly because of a message that we've been told by people that it sends a message to other victims out there that the hurdles are so high that nothing's going to happen anyways, and often people are reluctant to come forward anyways. And if it's if you make the hurdle even higher than it needs to be, then you're not helping things.
You'd said in a video that accompanied your articles that sexual misconduct has haunted USA Gymnastics for decades. Can you tell me and also explain to listeners a little bit more about that? I mean, people are probably aware of things that have occasionally popped up in the news, but did you all start looking a little bit at the history of the organization?
We did. USA Gymnastics started what they call a list of permanently ineligible members. We've just been calling it the banned coaches list. There are currently 107 people on that list, and it goes back to the 1990s. And one of the things we did was we looked at this list as it was published in two USA Gymnastics publications that are on available online going back to the 70s. And we plotted when some of these coaches started showing up on the list compared to when they were convicted. And we found in numerous situations there were long lapses of time between when a person was convicted and when they showed up on this banned coaches list. So the idea of this issue going back decades pretty much just comes from that, from the banned coaches list.
So that gave you a sense of a little bit of the scope of what could be out there, I would imagine, from looking at historically. And you would probably know that what you were seeing was only the tip of the iceberg, knowing that so many of these cases don't end up in convictions, certainly.
And just to add on to that, in depositions in the court case with former USA Gymnastics presidents, they did, dating back into the 90s, talk about that was an issue that they were dealing with back then as well. So there's also, you know, not only documentation and records, but there's testimony about how this has been something that they've been needing to address for a long time.
And since our story, we've had people come forward and say, it's been going on much longer than you think. We've had people say it's been going on since the 70s and the 80s. And, you know, there are a lot of documented cases, newspaper articles, those kind of things. So it's probably not unique to USA Gymnastics. It's, you know, it's been a societal problem, and it shows up in lots of youth-serving organizations.
Yeah, why don't you tell me a little bit more about the reaction to the story? Were you just hearing mostly about more cases involving USA Gymnastics? Was it, as you suggested, other different youth-serving organizations? Or how much have your phones been ringing since you published?
We set up a hotline and also an email address box to take stories. And we've been swamped with calls and emails. Many about USA Gymnastics specifically, but others about other organizations. And our effort in this always was to take a deeper look and a broader look. If people that are listening to this have stories they'd like to share with us, the hotline number is 317-444-6262, 317-444-6262, or they can email us at investigations with an S at indystar.com. As this goes on, we'll be broadening out, looking at other organizations and the broader issue of failure to report and the horrible impact that has on the victims and survivors.
Now tell me a little bit more about the Jane Doe lawsuit that was filed in April in Georgia. That was William McCabe, correct?
Correct. William McCabe was a coach and a then USA Gymnastics member who worked in a number of states, including Florida and Georgia. We also have some indication that he may have been in Pennsylvania and Ohio as well, and a number of other states. But allegations followed William McCabe throughout his coaching career. And we know that through those court records and through that lawsuit, that USA Gymnastics became aware of William McCabe and allegations of misconduct against him as early as 1998. when several gym owners sent letters to USA Gymnastics expressing concern about how he was interacting with people in the gym, underage individuals in the gym. For example, he said that he had gotten a 15-year-old down to her underwear and wanted to sleep with her very soon, and different things like that. And so the lawsuit relates to a young woman, a victim, who was secretly videotaped while she was changing clothes in McCabe's gym. And that was in 2005 is when it was happening, but he was charged in 2006.
And then one quick clarification. You mentioned that the lawsuit was filed in April. That was actually when the plaintiff filed an amended complaint. The lawsuit's actually more than 3 years old now.
2013, I think, is when it was filed.
Now, you spoke with one of the victim's mothers, correct?
We've spoken with a number of victims and victims' parents. Do you mean specific to the Georgia suit?
Yes. What did she tell you, and how did she view the situation? What was her take on what had happened and on what USA Gymnastics had to do with it, essentially?
I'm going to let Marissa answer that, but I want to just interject one thing. Marissa did the interview, but one of the things that stood out the most to me was the comment that he could have been stopped long before he got to our town. And that is just that kind of at the heart of it. And it's what we've seen looking at many other coaches where they bounce from gym to gym. People either don't report them or they get in trouble and they quietly leave town and go to another gym. And, you know, McCabe went around for maybe 10 years. And that summed up the interview. But Marissa can tell you more in detail.
Yeah, I think Kim did a great job of sort of summing up her thought process. And what she told us was that she feels that USA Gymnastics failed, and that USA Gymnastics had enough information to have done something about it. And she said, it didn't have to happen to my daughter, and it didn't have to happen to other little girls.
Wow, that's really powerful. Can you tell me about the three other cases that you tracked down details about?
Sure. Well, one was local. It involved a coach of two Olympians named Marvin Sharp from Indianapolis. And he was arrested late last year, on child abuse charges, and he ended up killing himself in jail. And we were able to find a letter that had been sent to USA Gymnastics 4 years earlier expressing concerns, detailed concerns, and saying he shouldn't be around children. They did not report that to law enforcement. They did, however, report in late 2015, USA Gymnastics, they are the ones who reported to law enforcement, reported Marvin Sharp after receiving another complaint, and that led to his arrest. But 4 years earlier, they did nothing. There's another case in Tennessee, a man by the name of Mark Schiefelbein, who had bounced from gym to gym over the years, sort of a classic case of complaints having been compiled. The victim's father said it was a file 3 inches thick when it was finally revealed in court. The victim was 10 years old, had been molested for about a year, told her mother finally. They reported him to authorities. There was a trial. He was convicted, sent to jail for 96 years. That was later reduced to 36. But what was unique about that situation is the family and the victim, who's now 26, herself a mother, spoke very openly, very movingly to us, especially, well, they're all on the record, especially Becca Seaborn was the victim, and we did a whole story on her, and it was deeply moving. The parents, of course, are outraged at USA Gymnastics not having warned anyone about the coach. And Becca, I thought, was quite brave in trying to talk about how those incidents, having been molested, doesn't define her for the rest of her life. Then there was one more, and Marissa knows more about that one, James Bell.
So we know through court records that USA Gymnastics had a sexual misconduct complaint file about Coach James Bell at least 5 years before he was arrested in Rhode Island in 2003 for molesting three young gymnasts. And we don't know what allegations were contained in that file, We know through records that USA Gymnastics compiled at least 54 complaint files relating to allegations of sexual misconduct against 54 coaches between 1996 and 2006. And we know that James Bell is one of those files, but we have a motion to intervene in the lawsuit in Georgia to try and get access to those documents and make them available to the public to see how they were handled by USA Gymnastics. But specific to James Bell, when we investigated his background, we found prior police reports about him in Oregon dating back to 1990. There was an underage gymnast who told police that Bell had climbed on top of her and wanted to take off her pants. In 91, there was a 10-year-old gymnast who said that Bell stuck his hand inside her shirt and had pinched her chest. But he wasn't charged in those cases, and he continued coaching until he was reported to police in Rhode Island for that case. And he actually was only sentenced last year, so he was charged in 2003, but he went on the run in 2004 and eluded authorities until 2015, spring of last year, when he was ultimately caught and pleaded guilty.
Wow.
And this is a guy who was on America's Most Wanted, and he was among Rhode Island's Most Wanted list, but he wasn't on the USA Gymnastics band coaches list.
That's incredible.
Can I add just a little inside journalism, I guess, twist is, you know, we identified some victims. We identified a victim's mother, but our policy is never to identify survivors of sexual abuse, sexual assault. These folks were people who agreed to speak out, who had come forward and felt so strongly about it. But, you know, when we've talked to lots of other people, we've heard their stories. It helped us establish patterns and those kind of things. But we clearly, you know, in the name of good journalism, don't identify folks like that unless they're willing and understand what we're doing with their names and their information.
And tell me a little bit more about the court action that the Indy Star has filed in the Georgia case. Why did the newspaper decide that this was the route to take, that simply writing about it and filing records requests wasn't going to bring out what needed to be brought out in terms of these cases?
What we were able to find in those four coaches is, you know, very anecdotal. It was snapshots. And what we realized is these 54 files could be more representative of patterns, of internal policies, of practices. And we also know that they've compiled files since 2006. We don't know the numbers. We've asked about that. But we felt like it was really important to be able to look at all of those files to really determine the patterns, their actions. Again, if we have four cases, they're pretty damning because we found these four coaches who went on to abuse at least 14 other children after these warnings. But again, we didn't want somebody to be able to dismiss those findings as those were the ones that fell through the cracks. You know, we're really much better than that. We wanted to dig down and see what they were really doing, and those case files, we hope, would share that information with us. And it was a hefty commitment by our publisher and our newspaper company to go after that. We're in a fight that's going to go, I'm sure, regardless of what happens at the local court level, it's going to be appealed in the state courts. In addition to Indy Star, we're part of the USA Today network, and they're supporting us. And again, it would have been easy to say, that's a long shot. You know, we're not going to fight a losing battle and pour a bunch of money down the drain. But to the credit, they've backed us. They've shipped people around the country working on this story, photographers. Marissa and Mark have traveled a lot. And we just think it's so important to be able to say that and establish a deeper pattern.
We have a hearing August 29th on our request to intervene and unseal those records. So we're excited about that.
And just as an aside, we filed our motion, I believe, was it June 13th, and asked for a speedy hearing on it within a week. Things sat until our story popped last week, and suddenly on Monday we got a hearing set. So I don't know if there's any coincidence or, cause and effect, but we're happy and looking forward to having a hearing on our motion.
Was there ever any talk about waiting to try to get those cases? I mean, maybe waiting for the court process, or did you have a sense going into that this might be a protracted process and so you need to publish before anyway?
That was a conversation that we had multiple times. You know, it's really important to us. I think it's important for people to know that we got this tip in the middle of March about this policy and about this lawsuit. You know, so we're talking about a very short time period in which we reviewed thousands of pages of records. And, you know, IndyStar made tons of records requests, and we flew all over the country. And so we did a lot in a very short period of time, and we tried to do it right. You know, it's a sensitive topic, and we wanted to make sure that we did this right and that we ran it when it was ready. And I can tell you that we talked a number of times about, you know, should we wait until the judge rules? But we ultimately decided, let's run this investigation when we're sure it's right and when it's accurate and when we have proof of this pattern. And that's when we decided to run it. And we, you know, we'll continue to pursue this. As my colleague said, you know, this is not done. We have other articles in the works for this investigation, and we're going to continue to pursue it up to and including when the judge rules on our motion.
Just as journalists, you know, we were chomping at the bit. Let's get this information in there. And once we filed our motion in the court in Georgia, the legal document kind of laid out our hypothesis and some of our findings or indications. And so we were sitting here knowing that if, thank goodness this was in kind of a small town where there's not a dogged reporter hanging at the courthouse, because it would have been very easy for someone to read our motion asking to open those records and say, gosh, there's a big story here. And so we had that looming. And the reality is, again, we expect this to be appealed regardless of how the judge rules initially. The issue is sensitive, and with the Olympics, there's always a big surge of new kids going to gyms, starting up after the Olympics, who are inspired by, you know, their American heroes. And we just thought it was important that we not sit on this information that we knew.
And from a journalism perspective, I'd also point out, you know, Tim mentioned the motion and the fact that it sort of laid out a lot of what we'd found, which made us pretty nervous because, you know, we were still pursuing information while we had that motion sitting out there since June. And so actually for a couple months, we had sort of a quick hit version of our investigation waiting, you know, just in case we needed to push the button on it early. And we're really, well, I'll speak for myself, I'm really glad that we didn't end up having to do that, because I think that, you know, we landed in a place where we did it the right way.
You also fought records denials in Oregon, correct?
We did, yes.
What happened there?
So we'd requested some records from local police departments. And first let me say that, you know, through all the records requests in many states that we put through, most officials were very, very helpful and were trying to get us the information that we were looking for. Specifically in Oregon, there's a law that can be read a number of ways. And there were a number of police departments that were reading it in the way that they couldn't give us copies of police reports relating to sexual abuse allegations, even if they were redacted, you know, for the victim's name and contact information and things like that. So it actually took about a month to get one of the police departments to finally release the record. And actually, the way that we got it was that we convinced a different police department in Oregon to give us their report on James Bell. And then we were able to go back to the other police department and say, well, this police department gave us the exact same record. Why can't you give it to us?
So, wow.
We were denied yesterday, right?
Oh, and yeah, and we were denied yesterday on a third police report. So, you know, it's a constant push and pull.
We did have, interestingly, we'd reached out to a victim in another case and had not heard back. But after our series ran, the prosecutor involved in that case reached out to us and said that the victim probably would be willing to talk to us. So, you know, I think once they saw how we handled things and what we were doing, you know, it may loosen some people up down the road, hopefully.
What has USA Gymnastics said in response to all of this?
They have not disputed any of our facts. What they've contended, and we would disagree with this, I think it's fair to characterize the reaction as having said that we omitted facts that would have made them look better. And they've also said that there are some things they can't say because they're in the middle of litigation. Steve Penny, the president of USA Gymnastics, he's in Rio, of course, at the Olympics, and he hasn't talked to anyone down there about this, and you know, nor did he talk to us, because talking about the current ongoing lawsuit. they've made a few statements. On Saturday, they had a press release from a child abuse advocacy group that talked about some good things Steve Penny had done on the issue. Other than that, it's kind of been it.
Was there ever any specific moment where you sort of hit a wall with the story? It sounds like maybe no, since you even had a version of it that was ready to publish weeks before the actual story came out. But was there maybe early on when you were worried that so much of this would be behind walls, either in courthouses or in USA Gymnastics file cabinet or sort of hidden away? Probably a lot of people who haven't even come forward at this point, that you were afraid you might not be able to sort of crack a systemic issue versus maybe having a couple examples? And how did you sort of push past that? Was there ever a moment where things slowed down and it was looking a little bit less clear? Or has the story had a momentum from the beginning?
The investigation had momentum from the very beginning. You know, the day that I received the tip about this lawsuit in Georgia, my bosses at the Indy Star put me on a plane, and I flew to Georgia, and then I drove 4 hours to this small courthouse and got all of the documents. There were almost 1,000 pages of records that we got right away, basically, and got back to the office, and Mark and Tim and I were reading through them and digging through them right away. And so we knew pretty early on what we had, but it was really for us about doing our due diligence and backgrounding more than 100 coaches and requesting public records to back up findings that we had to really make sure that not only did we understand the policy, but how it affected young gymnasts, how it affected parents, how it affected the coaches themselves as well.
I'll add, you know, we're three very different people personality-wise. I'm sorry, make myself laugh, but and there were definitely days where we went home feeling like, you know, this is never going to happen. You know, and there were days we went home just, you know, pumped and high-fiving as we went out the door. But, you know, in those down times, we all kind of rallied around. And some of those things were internal. Some of them were, is this lawsuit going to happen? Like any project, you kind of go up and down. But we continually moved forward. But, you know, there were times when we needed to buoy each other's spirits a little bit and bring others off the ledge and that kind of thing.
Yeah, I wasn't sure how many of these cases we were going to be able to document on our own and if it was going to be enough to publish without opening up those 54 case files. But we did. And so I suppose I was somewhat pessimistic about that aspect of this. But once we got a few more examples, then I knew we were rolling.
And then there's the whole final editing process for people who are journalism nerds, and that was a process, so we'll just leave it at that. But we were happy with what we came up with.
Well, it always is. And you all had spoken to a lot of people on background, you'd suggested, that weren't comfortable becoming public and being out in the public eye. Was that a difficult process for you and for them, I imagine, to sort of have these probably pretty intense conversations and to know that you would have to hold that in confidence, essentially, but, you know, still wanting to crack the story, basically?
I think that, you know, we definitely interviewed a lot of individuals on background, but I think the other thing that I would say, echoing something that Tim has said publicly earlier, is the fact that we had a, I consider it nice and lean, a 121-inch investigation, but there were a lot of people sort of that we interviewed, experts and things like that, that were saying similar things. And so we interviewed a lot of people that didn't make it into the final version that you see on IndyStar.com because they were just sort of echoing the same things. We just tried to get a diversity of opinions and a diversity of perspectives on this issue.
And there were people we had to work with and try to convince, get them to trust us enough to go on the record. And that was a process, too.
In one particular situation, Mark worked diligently, probably to the detriment of his marriage, with a person, almost daily calls at night to gain the trust and to build that relationship. And we actually, the three of us, traveled at one point to meet that person, to have a face-to-face. And, you know, but again, it's that kind of thing. And others, some of this stuff is so sensitive, and the language was so sensitive. In some cases, Mark and I would turn to Marissa and say, we think maybe you ought to talk to this victim, because I'm not comfortable talking to her about this word or that word and those kind of things. And
so I got to read all the really, you know, explicit words to the survivors.
Wow.
And the detriment to the marriage, that was a joke.
Yeah.
They're happily married.
They're doing quite well.
Well, thank you all so much for talking with me. It's and congratulations on some amazing work, and good luck going forward.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thanks, everyone, for listening.